You're listening to the podcast of the Leadership Center for Social Justice at United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. We seek to open a space for critical theological conversations about pressing social issues we face in our world today. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. I'm Rye Sickleco, and I direct the Leadership Center for Social Justice at United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. Today, I am delighted to be in conversation with one of United's own, Gary Green II. Gary is Assistant Professor of Pastoral Theology and Social Transformation here at United. He earned his PhD from Bright Divinity School, where he focused on issues related to young African-American men, through the lens of public pastoral theology. His dissertation, which is entitled Playing the Game, Unmarking Beast from the Bodies of Young Black Men, is a project that seeks to humanize young black men by allowing their voices to challenge stereotypical scripts that cast them as beasts for public consumption. Gary's broader research interests involve raising consciousness to issues of race, masculinity, and power, particularly when these issues are uniquely disclosed in spaces that are often overlooked by the church and the academy. Gary is committed to highlighting neglected sources in his research as a way to prioritize the revolutionary potential of voices that have gone unheard. His ultimate goal is to contribute to theological perspectives that can more adequately undergird socio-political redress for oppression in marginalized populations in the United States. Gary, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rye. I appreciate being here.
It's great to have you here.
It's good to finally be here with you in conversation.
Gary, your research focuses on racist representations of young black men as beasts for public consumption. You attend especially to the way in which such representations are both produced and reproduced in competitive sports. Mm-hmm. I thought we could begin our conversation by having you share a bit about your research and what led you into this specific area of study.
Yeah, thank you for asking this. This, like I was telling you kind of in the chat beforehand, it's been so long since talking about some of these ideas or this whole body, this work as a whole. And it came from my own experience growing up in the South in Texas and being very aware of the ways that I was looked at or seen in public and the way that and then paying attention to the way that I just inherently knew how to modulate my own presence publicly, read code switch is the language a lot of folks will use. Because of just being aware of the way that my blackness and my young maleness or whatever showed up and the way that it performed, even outside of my own behavior. And then also, you know, from experiences of being followed around in department stores, I mean, all of that stuff, being pulled over for no reason and harassed by police officers. And these are things that literally have happened. But then also the experience of being really kind of fetishized because I was always an athlete. And so, having a lot of success in sports and going to play college football in the Big 12 and the kind of success that came with that. But then also just paying attention to the way that, like, you know, I was treated because I was an athlete. And some of the assumptions and some of the scripts, as you mentioned in the bio, how they play out and how my humanity was something that was not really recognized. And being aware of, a lot of my peers had a similar experience where it's like, okay, when I'm in public and you don't know I'm an athlete, there's a certain air, there's a certain kind of assumption that you can feel when you are interacting with people in public space. When I'm in public and you do know I'm an athlete, all of a sudden there's this other kind of air where the language I use in my dissertation and kind of maybe will still use, but probably tweak a little bit now, is this kind of subhuman and superhuman assumption that plays out devoid of a recognition of humanity. Like, the fact that I'm a complex human being, that I think, I have emotions, I have feelings, those kinds of things were never part of the conversation because I was always related to either as another one of those guys, right? Or he's an exceptional athlete. So there's this kind of fetishization that plays out. And so this project really comes out of my attempt to understand racism, really, beyond the kind of moralisms or things that only speak to the subhuman history that when we talk about black men, but also wanted to understand how the fetishization still escapes a recognition of humanity in a fullness of what it is. And really this move to, and this is kind of more now than when I wrote the project, but now this move toward understanding, really trying to figure out a way to analyze racism and race beyond what I think is a moral impediment for society's capacity to recognize what's actually happening when racial situations play out. That it's more deeply formed and ingrained, and I think I might be getting ahead of the question now, but it lives at a level that is underneath intention, that is underneath moral sensibility. How do we understand how racism plays out by well-meaning, you know, participants in death-dealing ways? You know, it's not always the kind of evil that every time something happens, you turn on CNN, you turn on MSNBC, maybe you turn on Fox News, and it's always in the language of moral, like, this person is a racist. And my sense is it's deeper than that. There's a relational science that I think we need to better understand.
You describe your dissertation, Playing the Game, as a work of pastoral theology, and I know you are a pastoral theologian, but it's pastoral theology of a particular sort, it seems to me, in that you are rather self-consciously engaged in doing pastoral theology as a form of cultural criticism. And while your work demonstrates a deep concern for care in pastoral practice, and specifically the pastoral care of young black men, you situate such concerns within the wider sociopolitical context in which pastoral care takes place. I know that for you, this also entails a deep commitment to social transformation and social justice. I wonder if you could talk about how you understand your work, I guess, within the context of the field of pastoral theology, and the ways in which your work also marks out a kind of intervention in that field.
Oh, yeah. You know, at the core of that, it's the recognition that traditionally the kind of therapeutic focus that pastoral theology had before the last few decades, that has started to shift. Recognizing that if I were to go to therapy, that would only go so far. There are things that happen to black men in this country that therapy can't account for. I mean, like literal death sometimes, but even beyond that, the kind of therapeutic harm that can be done or healing can only go so far if the structures or the sociopolitical practices in public space and otherwise is not altered. Like to not address the reason why many black men need therapy in the first place is not to truly care. That to truly care for this group of people, of humans, then the therapeutic is one piece of it, but there needs to be changes to the kind of broader realities that are creating the problems and maintaining them in the first place. And I think that is just the extent to which I go to that end might be an intervention in pastoral theology. It's the best way that I can understand, you know, if I'm asked the question of care in relation to black men, we can't talk about care without talking about what that looks like on a social and political level. And so that's really, you know, that just to speak to that a little bit, I mean, that's kind of where I am. Pastoral theology and the program that I was in at Bright Divinity School had that in mind, but it was not necessarily as explicit as I'm trying to make it, where I'm trying to focus on the social and political realities first as a foundational core piece of care, even while my colleagues and other folks are focusing on the therapeutic.
So that's already a shift that's happening in, or has been happening in pastoral theology, away from sort of individualized sort of therapeutic kind of interests, but more into a kind of socio-political viewing questions of care within the larger context. So you see your work as a kind of deepening of the work that's already been going on in the field, or is that
definitely fair? Definitely. I see that work began decades ago, and you know, to varying degrees, caught on. It didn't catch on. It depends on the scholar that you kind of were mm-hmm. conversant with. But the folks that I was formed in relation to were already thinking about it. It was therapy, mm-hmm. but then also this. There was still kind of that traditional commitment to care mm-hmm. that was predicated on a definition of a person, really as an individual. And it's not until later, and a little thread going through pastoral theology that understood the human as not necessarily individual, but foundationally relational, which meant even the formation of a person mm-hmm. is directly connected to their environment, to the cultural realities, social and political realities in which they exist. And so then for me, and when I was learning that from scholars, from mentors, it was for me, the logical conclusion of that is, okay, then we have to talk about that first, the formation, the kind of reality in which I come to even exist as a human person first, before talking about what has supposedly gone wrong in me to not be able right. to adjust or stand up under all of this.
Right.
Right. And so for me, it was let's understand how this inhumanity that continues to play out is not just treated, but how has it been produced in the first place? And how do we continue to produce inhumanity onto and inscribe that onto Black men's bodies, mm-hmm. Black men and women's bodies. Mm-hmm.
Your research engages in a series of case studies in which you interview several current and former young Black athletes. You say that the goal of the project is to, quote, uncover the ways in which young Black men are seen as inhuman, evinced through lenses of sub and superhumanity. You explore the history of the racialized trope of Black men as beasts, which you note simultaneously represents Black men as subhuman and superhuman, a source of both racialized fears and fetish. And you reflect on the former NFL superstar Marshawn Lynch, who you say epitomizes both the appeal and problematic racial nature of beast. I wonder if you could share a bit about the history of this racist trope and how you see it on display today in representations of young Black men and perhaps athletes in particular.
Yeah, thank you. I'll enter in through Marshawn Lynch as a model to speak about both that history and the contemporary, I would say, performance of that. When you look at Marshawn Lynch, especially when he was playing with the Seahawks and you know, he's got the dreads, he's got the tattoos, he's a big strapping guy. And he did not want to talk to the media because he understood what the media would regularly do to the narratives of Black players in terms of twisting them and making them, you know, they making them come off as something they're not. And so he began to be defiant with respect to the rule in the NFL that one needs to give interviews, and there's a minimum amount of time that you have to be accessible to the media. And so he would show up and he would just say the same thing you might remember, but I'm just here so I don't get fined. And that was effectively his protest. To hear all of the language of like thug that came out of that mm-hmm. by the media and by many, I mean, I would hear people talking about Marshawn Lynch as if they knew him. And so that was a problem. And for me, it pointed to a broader history that we see play out with respect to police violence, with respect to the levels of containment that you know, the extent to which Black men are incarcerated in this country, and how a common refrain undergirding all of those was this sense that this person was a threat in some kind of way. This person is in some way not capable of controlling themselves. So then there's the need to contain or control them, or perhaps even kill them, because Black men free in the United States and in their agency and vocal are dangerous, are a problem for many. And so it's, you know, slavery had to assume, the period of antebellum slavery had to assume that Black men and women were not human in order to be able to treat them like chattel. When slavery, when emancipation happened and you moved into Jim Crow, this is when beast, as something even more explicit, became even more politically necessary, because now you needed another way to control those same bodies that enslavement allowed you to do legally. Mm-hmm. So now this is when KKK, this is when the police were formed, as a way to continue that legacy of controlling Black men in extra legal ways with different methods. Hence, that's when lynching comes into play. And that was based on largely, lynching was based largely on a narrative that assumed that Black men were physically capable, kind of superhuman. Mm-hmm. But when it came to rational capability, or when it came to really what was defined as their humanity, they were less than and therefore needed to be controlled, because they were in pursuit of white women, and this was the narrative. They're physical beasts that are overly sexual, that are physical, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So when you look at how that plays out today, you know, some of the examples that come to my mind are, one is the language and the ease with which Black athletes are called beasts, right, in the celebratory way. Mm-hmm. Because there's a recognition of a kind of dominance or a prowess, an extraordinary capability in that sport. But how often do we use the language to talk about beast with Marshawn Lynch and it means something more than physical, right? It's always couched in this like physical capacity, perhaps devoid of humanity, or perhaps devoid of the same kind of sensibility that you would think about with respect to like a Tom Brady, for example. I'm trying not to get too much in the weeds, but even my interviewees in this dissertation project had a harder time calling Tom Brady a beast when they had previously defined beast as, you know, this is something like when you were just dominating, right? Anybody mm-hmm. can do this in sport. But there was a reticence to calling Tom Brady a beast, whereas there was a willingness to recognize the same thing in Marshawn Lynch. And underneath that, there was this sense of, well, Tom Brady's the GOAT. You know, he's not really a beast in that sense, right? So you hear this even undertone, even among Black athletes. But, you know, seeing LeBron James on the front of a cover of a magazine depicted as King Kong, the language of Beast of the East, or when Marshawn Lynch himself talks about going into beast mode and is describing it as going into a flow state, which is a neuroscientific, a neurological level of functioning, a kind of an altered state of consciousness that lands more as intelligence than just looking at him as a physical specimen that's running around knocking people out the way. I probably went way off track, but hopefully, you know, what I'm trying to do is there's a through line that to pull through. And I think in the world that we live in now, where everybody is exploited, and athletes are depicted publicly for the sake of just generating wealth and money and whatever, that it still plays on that narrative historically, but it does so in a way that is more celebrated and therefore is not recognized for the harm that it can maintain.
Right. Well, this leads into the next question, which is what you call the three prongs of the American pitchfork through which young Black men are targeted. These prongs, and really you describe them as cycles,
yeah.
our containment, crucifixion, and commodification? I think this is a good question to kind of transition to, because you know, you've been talking about the scripts, right, that are used to target to contain black men in particular kinds of ways, whether that's right. in terms of the subhumanity or in terms of framing, in terms of a superhumanity.
Right.
I wonder if you could share about each of these three prongs and how you understand these to function as fundamental scripts or inscriptions of inhumanity, as forms of marking, as you put it, young black men as beasts.
Yeah. You know, I chose that language partly because I'm historically a Baptist preacher and alliteration works, but more deeply, you know, really trying to understand what is the reality that's playing out? What does it look like? And the language of cycles, I even use the language of realities specifically because to me, I understand that to be any kind of closed system of kind of interrelated functioning that has kind of taken on a life of its own, where the participants are in this kind of ritualized way of relating to each other without having to think much about it.
Hmm.
And I would even define capital R reality that way as well, but it's hard for us to fathom it in that crass maybe of terms, is because we are all participating in it, but we are upholding it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so this is me trying to understand, when I look at what are the realities, the social, political kind of closed systems that seem like they function on their own, that are most pressing to and threatening to black men. Well, one, you could talk about incarceration, and Michelle Alexander and a host of other scholars have talked about the problem of mass incarceration and the fact that there's a pipeline that begins early in grade school that is designed to feed directly into this reality, right, to keep it in play. But then also the crucifixion comes specifically from the routine ways in which black men are killed by state are products of state violence. We're not mm-hmm. products of, but the result, you know, the killing of black men is a product of state violence, mm-hmm. Whether physical violence or other forms that you could, you know, theorize in a broader sense. But it's a very public way in which black men continue to, i.e. similar to lynching historically, but there's a terroristic element to what happened to Mike Brown or what happens to other black men who may not have been left on the street for hours for all to see, but their pictures are particular kinds of pictures of them are paraded around on the news. And, you know, there's just a public dimension to our death that I think has a design, a kind of terroristic design to it, similarly to lynching and to crucifixion and the way that was meant to function from empire. And part of this, I think, is because we still have to talk about empire. It just functions in a little different way now. Commodification was my recognition that, okay, if I avoid being locked up, going to prison one day, right? Beat the statistics in that sense. And if I can avoid being killed by the police or whoever, beat the statistics in that place, you know, the design of this thing that we're talking about, I have to acknowledge that at every point of my life, I have still had to consent to certain things that really feel like a commodification of my black maleness or blackness or whatever it might be, especially in sport. As a means to kind of quote unquote making it out, or as a means to success, the things that I had to say yes to as an athlete, knowing that I was not being appreciated for anything more than what my body could do in front of people but in space, that even that was not recognized as a signal of a complex humanity or even an intellectual capability to navigate certain kinds of space. and having to be kind of okay with that because of the need of doing this or that or that. That was a problem for me. And it becomes truly a way for me to understand, you know, what are Black men having to, what is the terrain that we're having to negotiate in order to survive, in order to flourish? It's rotten, really, even in the best cases. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that. I want to understand that. To figure out what has to be done for those scripts that continue to play out to no longer register in our minds so that we can get out of this really kind of ritualistic charade that continues to breathe life into this racist history.
I want us to transition now to the constructive dimension of your work, which charts out a proposal for a pastoral theology that takes seriously the suffering that young Black men are forced to endure as a consequence of racist oppression. For you, such oppression is a direct assault not only on the body, but also on the soul. Your proposal, if I understand it correctly, is for a mode and method of pastoral care that incites a creative freedom, which might have the capacity to disrupt the markings that dehumanize young Black men, to disrupt the cycles.
Yeah.
Toward this end, you highlight the significance of play as one site of relational performance that can powerfully challenge and disrupt ritualized and routinized cycles of containment, crucifixion, and commodification. I wonder if you could share more about this constructive dimension of your work and how it might relate practically to a pastoral practice that is engaged in the practice of freedom, disrupting the violence of white supremacy.
This is probably one of those parts of the project that has evolved the most since I wrote my dissertation, and one that I've tried to understand the most in terms of, okay, so if this is the reality that continues to play out, how do we change it? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that continues to come to my mind, and it's even, I'm recalling even growing up and loving stand-up comedy and the way that comedians could see through reality and know and point out things in front of us that we do that is absurd, and yet not in the context of a stand-up comedy bit, we do it, and we are oftentimes very committed to doing it that way. And so it was just like, well, then why is it why can we suspend reality so much in a stand-up comedy setting or in a barbershop when I'm having conversations with brothers or whatever, wherever it might be? And for me, it kept coming back to play space. How, you know, if I'm defining reality largely in this way that understands it as a kind of a ritualized performance of meaning, of practice, habit, that is on a cultural level, that has become second nature to many of its participants who can carry it out but not be doing anything malicious or explicitly racist, then the only way to interrupt that or to change that is first to disrupt it, because it exists as this kind of flow, right? And play, or the world of fantasy, right? If you're talking about reality, then for me it was like, well, how do I conceive of fantasy? Hmm. As this world of possibilities outside of what we are already used to doing in relation, right? Before COVID, if you told me that we were all going to be wearing masks in a couple months, that would have seemed like a fantasy. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, because of a virus and because of the need to protect ourselves and each other, wearing a mask became a second nature performance pretty quickly. And so just seeing the slippage in that, seeing how fickle and perpetually ready to be transformed realities are, then I started paying attention to how play spaces that are unencumbered by the politics of the realities we're trying to understand or transform, spaces that are largely kind of self-determined. When I think about the times when I am with a group of my cousins or other, you know, black buddies of mine, and where it's just us, and the healing that happens in that space, the disruptive ideas that happen in that space, where we leave with ideas about how we can return to or relate to the realities from which we come, and be disruptive in a creative kind of way to change the nature of this ongoing thing that we're living in relation to. And this is just one approach to it, because there are structural and political, like policy changes that have to happen. But there's a creative way in which this life that we carry, this life that we have, this vitality, can be incited, can be kind of energized. And it happens almost in this kind of magical way in play space. And so for me, when I had to go back to the question of care and what does that look like in a pastoral practice sense? For me, one of those things is for black men to be able to create play spaces, black women to be able to create play spaces. And of course, you could talk more about how you define that space, what should and should not happen in that. But there's the sheer possibilities of what can come out of that, and the healing that is inherent to those kinds of spaces. That's one thing that no matter what happens on a societal level, we can cultivate. And understanding that even the attempt to cultivate that space is disruptive in and of itself, because so much of our racist history in this country has also been predicated on not allowing those kinds of spaces. Whether you go back to antebellum slavery, whether you go back to Jim, wherever you go, the enclaves of black creative genius that have been untouched have both healed and transformed and have been targeted. Because I think there's an inherent understanding of what can happen when you are in a communal space of being able to be creative, powerful, and healthy.
Well, I think of music too, you know, spirituals, the blues, right? Jazz.
Yeah.
I mean, music is a site of play, of imagination. That can be very disruptive.
Absolutely.
And spaces of creativity,
right?
Where new worlds can be born, where new ideas can take shape, where a different kind of politics, revolutionary politics can emerge precisely out of those spaces.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, I think understanding play more, especially in understanding how it relates to like this work reality that we live in, or reality as a whole, will open up more of those possibilities, because then we realize the value of it. And like you said, mute, like jazz, I mean, this music born from struggle in those play spaces, born for the purpose of sustaining a community, but then also born for the purpose of disrupting a reality. And you could probably do a study on, you know, the ideas that fueled movements and where those ideas were born. I would put my money on it. In some way, this idea came out of this collective kind of play space, or at least was nurtured in a way that then it became real all of a sudden. And then society had to adjust to it.
Well, Gary, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. Your work is incredibly creative and challenging, and I've really learned a lot from being in conversation with you. It's such a pleasure to think with you and to work alongside you here at United. And to listeners, I wanted to add that you can look forward to hearing more from Gary on this podcast in the weeks and months ahead, as he will join us as one of our hosts for a number of episodes.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Gary, thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Leadership Center for Social Justice podcast. To learn more about the center and its programs, visit unitedseminary.edu/LCSJ or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at United_LCSJ.